This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, March 10th, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, an accusation over teaching creationism at school is raising questions regarding charter authorization in Arkansas. Plus, problems caused by pythons in the Everglades. Also, the music of West Memphis in the latest installment of Arkansongs. Ruby Brock has his weekly business and political news recap and more. But first, the key prosecution witness in the bribery and extortion trial of former Arkansas Treasurer Martha Shoffner is expected to return to the stand today. During testimony Friday, bond broker Steele Stevens detailed how Shoffner had told him she was having trouble paying for a Little Rock apartment, and he agreed to give her $1,000 a month to cover rent. The money was supplied in sums of $6,000 once every 6 months. Stevens testified that in exchange, the amount of state investments going through him drastically increased. Reporter Rob Moritz is covering the trial, and he says proceedings began with a taped conversation between Stevens and Shoffner that occurred in January of last year.
Mr. Stevens had just agreed around that time to help the FBI in their investigation, and Mike drove up to Newport and met with Martha Shoffner. Today, the jury is going to hear the second tape. Meeting between Steele Stevens and Martha Shoffner, and that happened in May of 2013. During that visit, he brought $6,000 in a pie box up to her house, and she was later taken into custody by the FBI.
Also today, defense attorney Chuck Banks may get a chance to cross-examine Stevens. The federal trial is expected to last through the end of the week. 4 consecutive months of lower-than-projected revenue from court fees and fines are causing a 25% reduction in funding from that revenue source to a number of court-related entities. The Arkansas Access to Justice Commission coordinates legal services for low-income Arkansans and is among several agencies facing budget constraints this month. The commission's director, Amy Johnson, says cuts will affect some of the state's most vulnerable residents.
Legal Aid of Arkansas and the Center for Arkansas Legal Services are the state's two nonprofit civil legal aid providers, and these cuts are going to affect their ability to serve folks for civil legal issues involving basic human needs, protection from domestic violence, safe and habitable housing, those types of issues.
Johnson says she understands the cuts may only be temporary, but they highlight a larger funding problem.
The other unfortunate thing about this, I think that relying on court fees and fines for revenue to support the operations of the court system, I mean, administration of justice and access to legal representation, I think is problematic because those disproportionately affect low-income folks.
Arkansas Access to Justice Commission works to coordinate civil legal aid for more than 15,000 clients a year. The organization states that even before these cuts, more than half of those who qualified for free services had to be turned away. Both of the state's law schools, the state police, the state crime laboratory, and other court programs are also facing the challenges of reduced funding. This fiscal session's final action of the state's alternative to Medicaid expansion, known as the private option, took place Friday when Governor Mike Beebe signed the funding bill into law. Governor Beebe touted the nationally followed program in his weekly address and reflected on his legacy as governor.
I never expected my final years as governor to be centered around health care after years of focus on education and economic development. But healthy kids perform better in school, and a healthier workforce can attract more companies. It will be up to future governors and legislators to decide whether to maintain or change the private option. For now, it offers a chance for Arkansans to lead healthier, happier lives.
The private option will again face a tough legislative hurdle when it comes back up for a vote during next year's regular legislative session. Smoke will loom over portions of Hobbs State Park Conservation Area beginning today. According to park officials, 4 controlled burns will be conducted at areas throughout the conservation area from today through the end of the month. Crews from Arkansas State Parks, the Arkansas Forestry Commission, and local fire departments will conduct the burns, which are aimed at reducing fuel loads in the woods. Reducing the fuel load will help prevent wildfires and promote a healthy forest. The burns will be conducted in the Blackburn Creek area near the public shooting range, in the Van Hollow area between Piney Road and Little Cliffy Creek, at the lookout area near Highways 12 and 127, and at Jeske Place along War Eagle Creek. Road work in Springdale will cause overnight lane closures beginning tonight. Construction crews will begin installing bridge girders at the new Don Tyson Parkway interchange. The work is expected to take about 3 weeks to complete, during which time traffic will be limited to one lane between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. on weekdays. The work will also require traffic along the interstate to be stopped for 15-minute intervals between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. while the bridge girders are positioned over the travel lanes. The Razorback baseball team had mixed fortunes during the Cal Baseball Classic this weekend. While Arkansas won a 4-0 decision Saturday against Tulane, the Razorbacks fell 2-1 in Friday's game against San Francisco and lost both games of a doubleheader yesterday against UC Berkeley. The Razorbacks return to the road this Friday with a 3-game set against Florida. In other Razorback news, Tom Collin has been dismissed as the head coach for women's basketball. According to a UA announcement Friday, Athletics Director Jeff Long said the dismissal was in the long-term interest of the women's basketball program. Long further stated that the women's basketball program hasn't made significant progress toward consistent appearances in SEC championships or in the NCAA tournament. Collin has served as head coach for Arkansas women's basketball since 2007. Clear tonight with lows around 48 degrees. Mostly sunny tomorrow with highs in the mid to upper 70s throughout the listening area. And mostly cloudy tomorrow night with a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms and a low around 36 in northwest Arkansas. In the Arkansas River Valley, there's a 20% chance of evening showers and you can expect a low around 41. This is Ozarks at Large. A public charter school management corporation that operates several campuses in Arkansas teaches creationism. That's according to a complaint filed to the Arkansas Department of Education. Responsive Education Solutions, based in Texas, denies the allegation. The State Department of Education is quietly reviewing the matter. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the controversy raises questions regarding charter authorization in Arkansas.
On February 10th, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, a nonprofit watchdog group in Washington, D.C., filed a complaint to the Arkansas Department of Education claiming that Responsive Education Solutions' science curriculum aggressively undermines the theory of evolution and promotes creationism. Also referred to as intelligent design, creationism espouses a biblical view that Earth, including humans, were created by God 6,000 years ago, that we and all of life did not evolve over a 4.5 billion year span. Americans United staff attorney Ian Smith.
Within the first three pages, on pages 2 and 3, they say that evolution is an unproved theory that has been elevated to the level of dogma. They say that it was a theory that was thought up by scientists who didn't believe in God so that they didn't have to resort to God to explain how life began, right? The federal courts have said you can't teach creationism in science classes.
Responsive Education Solutions, Responsive Ed for short, operates 65 campuses across Texas and is getting a purchase on Arkansas. A half dozen charter firms run 34 public charter schools across the state. Two Responsive Ed schools include a high school campus in Little Rock and the newly opened Northwest Arkansas Classical Academy in Bentonville. We requested an academy tour with the headmaster and an interview about the curriculum controversy, but was told to contact corporate headquarters in Texas. Spokesperson Griff Griffin declined to talk on tape. Instead, he furnished documents issued from Responsive Ed CEO Chuck Cook. In a letter written to the Arkansas Department of Education, Cook says their lessons are constitutionally acceptable as written, and that creationism is mentioned only in passing 6 times. Americans United for Church and State staff attorney Ian Smith says it's just a ploy.
They'll give the kids the information, but then they poke at it. It's that positioning of it as the alternative to evolution right after you get done bashing evolution.
Responsive Ed has pulled the culprit curriculum. The Arkansas Department of Education, which declined commenting on tape for this report, has issued a response to Americans United, saying public charters like regular public schools must comply with the state board's curriculum frameworks. Three members of the State Board of Education also would not talk on record. And when queried, charter experts at the highest level, the U.S. Department of Education, said it was a state matter. They will, however, be monitoring the situation. University of Arkansas Education Policy Professor Dr. Gary Ritter researches charter efficacy. He says public charter school applicants in Arkansas must first pass through the state's new charter authorizing panel.
This board works at the Arkansas Department of Education, and high-level administrators at the ADE serve on this board. They include Tom Kimbrell, the Commissioner of Education, and some associate commissioners. I think that's what they're called. Megan Watonsky, John Hoy, Karen Walters Cushman, a couple others. These are people who've worked in schools most of their lives, worked in districts, they've managed districts. They understand how schools operate.
Up until last year, the State Board of Education reviewed charter applicants.
The feeling is different. The questions now are more about how a school gets run. How are these potential school leaders going to balance the books? What curriculum strategies are they going to use? How are they going to make sure there's transportation for the students? These types of questions, to me, appear to be more professional and more related to the day-to-day educational operations of the school.
Gary Ritter says the charter authorization process is rigorous but not exhaustive.
The charter authorizing panel doesn't go through every single piece of curriculum that the school is going to teach in K through 12 for all of its students and all of its years. So they ask lots of questions about what general curriculum guidelines they're going to use, maybe what textbook series they're going to use. But I don't believe they go through every single page of curriculum. In the same way, no one at the state goes through every single page of curriculum that will be delivered at every traditional public school.
And it's not just charters advancing creationism. The American Civil Liberties Union of Arkansas recently accused a Little Rock School District middle school for instructing students that evolution is fallible. William F. McComas, a professor of science education, curriculum, and instruction at the University of Arkansas, says, like it or not, creationism is commonly taught by rogue teachers across America.
It turns out that perhaps as many as a third of all biology teachers nationally, it may be that number may be somewhat higher regionally, but about a third nationally either don't teach evolution, which is bad enough, or they minimize it. That, again, that's bad enough. But a great number of those folks will actually actively talk against evolution as the foundation for biology, the science of biology. And I find that extraordinarily troubling.
And Professor McComas says certain instructors with a fundamentalist Christian perspective are compelled to teach creationism.
The notion of choice becomes the sort of wedge that creationists tend to employ, stating, well, you know, shouldn't we give students all sides of the argument and then let them choose? And yet ultimately we want students to reject evolution for some rather dubious reasons. So I think in a nutshell that pretty much sums up the creationist strategy.
And while school districts are responsible for making sure curriculum standards are correctly taught, public charters must also be held equally accountable.
My understanding, both as an educator and as a taxpayer, is that if a school is receiving public money for the services that they're providing to students, even if it's in a charter situation, they are obligated to a best standards approach to the teaching of science, and a best standards approach would most certainly include evolution and would most certainly exclude metaphysical notions like creationism.
An examination of Responsive Ed's 2013 financials show the firm took in more than $92 million in state and federal public school revenue. And now, covert creationist instructors will have to reckon with next generation, new national public education science standards, which of course teaches evolution. In the end, what Professor William McComas argues is that perhaps it's time for intelligent design adherents to embrace evolution as genesis.
To me, that is the compromise, if a compromise is even necessary. I just don't think that evolution, as the guiding principle of the life sciences, is a threat to anyone who understands what it is. So people who choose to reject the reality of evolution do so in the face of extremely powerful evidence. And I just don't understand why. I don't understand why people would choose to ignore this line of thinking, this line of evidence that extends back, you know, more than a century. There is no doubt that evolution has occurred.
Responsive Ed's charter will come up for review before the Arkansas Charter Authorizing Panel over the next several years. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life.
Oh my God.
One thing I really like in a radio story.
What's back there?
Nothing.
It looks empty.
No, there's someone living back there.
Is a mystery.
I'm not going back there.
There's somebody's hair. There's a head in there.
There's a shrunken head right there.
Mysteries explained each week. This American Life.
It's Santa Claus.
Resident Evil?
Listen to This American Life Sundays at 10 a.m. on KUAF.
After a number of tries, the private option is passed, and Roby Brock has the details in his weekly business and political news recap.
On a fifth and final effort, the Arkansas House of Representatives passed a funding measure for the private option health insurance program. The bill passed the House by a 76-24 margin with one vote to spare. Representatives Kim Hammer, Les Carnine, and Mary Lou Slinkard, all Republicans, all voted yes for the first time in the 2014 fiscal session to pass the measure. The federal trial of former Arkansas Treasurer Martha Shoffner began on Wednesday. Shoffner's been charged with 6 counts of extortion, 1 count of attempted extortion, and 7 counts of receipt of a bribe by an agent of a state government receiving federal funds. She's also facing 10 additional counts of mail fraud. This week, prosecution witnesses portrayed Shoffner as combative with staff members and unconcerned with potential business deals that might raise red flags with state auditors. Russ Harrington, the longtime CEO of Little Rock-based Baptist Health System, will retire July 1st and be succeeded by Troy Wells, who currently holds the title of Senior Vice President of Administrative Services for the healthcare group. Baptist Health made the announcement on Monday. Harrington will retire after 40 years of service to the company. Simmons First National Corporation filed notice with the Securities and Exchange Commission that it would consolidate its 7 subsidiary banks into a single banking organization. The consolidation of charters will occur in 2 phases, the bank said. CEO George Makris said that there are many operational functions that are currently performed separately for each of the 7 banks. After the consolidation, those tasks will only need to be performed one time. The U.S. Department of Defense has awarded Tyson Foods a 3-year contract worth a maximum of $444 million to supply chicken to the federal government. The contract is for commercial chicken items. It's described as fixed price with an economic price adjustment component. Overseas vendors supporting overseas military customers also will order from the contract, the department said. Tyson was chosen from a group of 9 offers received through a competitive bid process. Mountain Valley Water Company of Hot Springs has been acquired by a group of investors with Kansas City-based Great Range Capital. Terms of the deal were not disclosed. Great Range Capital is a private equity firm. Mountain Valley is the oldest continuously operated bottled water company in the U.S. and has been in business since 1871. The CEO of Union Pacific Corporation, the railroad transportation giant, told a Little Rock audience that he sees positive signs in the U.S. economy, particularly in the agricultural, chemical, and auto business. Jack Kordaleski, who served as CEO since 2012, told the Arkansas Economic Development Foundation, which is the nonprofit arm of the state's economic development agency, that early trends in his transportation portfolio are off to a good start in 2014. He also cited upticks in business related to energy and manufacturing as a boost for stronger revenues in the coming year. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business and Politics update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com.
Who am I?
My name is Ish. On my hand, I have a dish. I have this dish to help me wish. When I wish to make a wish, I wave my hand with a big swish swish.
Last Friday afternoon, a small group of children and their parents gathered inside a room at Best Start Pediatric Clinic in Springdale in celebration of the 17th annual Read Across America Day. Dr. Susan Averett read Dr. Seuss's book, One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish, aloud to her young guests. The walls of the small room were decorated with Dr. Seuss characters like the Cat in the Hat and Thing One. A table in the room contained snacks as well as Lorax mustaches and Cat in the Hat hats for the children to wear. Read Across America is a National Education Association reading motivation and awareness program that calls for every child in every community to celebrate reading on the birthday of Dr. Seuss. The local celebration was originally slated for last Monday, but was rescheduled due to the recent winter storm. Friday was also cause for celebration because the Rogers chapter of Delta Kappa Gamma, a professional honorary society of women educators, presented the pediatric clinic with more than 200 books. Ann Averett, president of the organization's Rogers chapter, says this is the first time the local group has organized this type of project.
Last year, we had Dr. Averett as our speaker. She's also my daughter, so we have a little connection there. But she came and talked to us about their Reach Out and Read program that gives books to children when they come in for a well checkup, everywhere from six weeks through age five. Every well checkup, the child is given a book and the parent is talked to about the importance of reading. So she told us about that project at our meeting, and then that started us being interested in providing books because we know she needs hundreds of books to give away for these well checkups. So we decided that would be a good project. Then we heard about the grant and everything began to come together.
That grant was a $500 award that came from the state level of Delta Kappa Gamma. The local chapter supplemented that amount with an additional $300 members collected through fundraising efforts, which included selling reading glasses and gift wrapping at Barnes & Noble during the Christmas season. Ann says they purchased books from various locations, including Barnes & Noble, who gave them a discounted rate. When purchasing the books, they had to search for more durable ones because they will be given to young children.
She said she needed mostly board books because most of the children who get the books are very young. 5 years is the oldest. So the five-year-olds don't have to have board books, but all the rest of them do because they tend to eat and tear their books. So they need very sturdy books. So we chose mostly board books or books that would appeal to young children and just books that were beautiful and that we fell in love with. The most fun of the whole thing was the shopping.
According to its website, Delta Kappa Gamma Society International promotes professional and personal growth of women educators and excellence in education. Ann says the organization provides scholarships for girls going into education as well as to members who want to further their own education. The Rogers chapter meets once a month, and its members keep informed about what's going on in education. For example, Ann says they've discussed the new Common Core curriculum that's being implemented in schools. During another meeting, one member who has written a book discussed the publishing process. Ann says one time the group went to Dillard's for makeovers because the group is also about fellowship and improving the morale of its teachers. Ann retired after 33 years of teaching, but why did she initially decide to become an educator?
That's been so long ago. My mother was a teacher, and I was always a fairly good student. It turned out that it's much harder than being a student. Everybody doesn't follow the rules the way I did when I was in school, so it's a lot to learn. I thought all you had to do was just tell, because it was the way it was with me. And then, so it started, fifth grade was my first teaching job, and that was in Atlanta. I went down there for my husband to go to graduate school, but most of my teaching has been in Arkansas. I actually began teaching the year my mother retired, so it was kind of a continuity there.
Before retiring a few years ago, Ann taught reading recovery and early literacy at Bonnie Grimes Elementary School in Rogers, and she says it's never too early to start reading to a child.
really can even start in the womb. The baby learns to listen to that voice, and it's very calming, and then recognizes the voice later on. And then the child comes to school. We call it the 1,000-hour club. If they've been read to 1,000 hours from birth on up to the time they enter kindergarten, then they have a huge advantage over a child who has not seen a book, doesn't know which way to turn the page, doesn't know what even the listening is all about. So you'll see that the children who've been read to choose that. They're eager to be read to. The others don't know what it's all about, don't want to sit still, get up and wander off. And then that leads automatically into reading. Many children will start spontaneously reading, teaching themselves after having been read to enough.
For more information about Delta Kappa Gamma, you can visit kappastate.weebly.com.
I do not like this one so well. All he does is yell, yell, yell. I will not have this one about. When he comes in, I put him out. This one is quiet as a mouse. I like to have him in the house. Do y'all like quiet or noisy things?
Quiet.
That's right.
Quiet. It is Monday, March 10th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You see a lot of music.
I do. Not nearly as much this year yet, but...
But you will.
I will correct that.
There is a huge selection today and tomorrow.
Okay.
And you know, if I'm talking about music, it's Kevin's hand, my mouth.
Yes, music Kevin writer.
Kevin Kinder, our music writer, mm-hmm. So... The Lyric Quintet is performing at 7:30 tonight at the Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall at the University in Fayetteville. It is a guest performance with the Paulink Sextet, and that is free. There's a farewell recital tonight at 7:30 at Breedlove Auditorium at UAFS in Fort Smith. Charles L. Booker, Jr., who is Associate Professor of Theory and Composition, is retiring or resigning, and his son Adam Booker is going to be on hand to perform with him.
Very cool.
And then for something completely different, Harmar Superstar. I remember writing about this guy, his real name is Sean Tillman, a long time ago when he played Clunk Music Hall. Ah, I see you remembering.
It sounds familiar. I never got to see Clunk's Music Hall, but I have heard of it.
Well, he is odd. But he's got a new album out, Bye Bye 17, and British music magazine New Music Express says he ditches raunch and irony for old-fashioned songwriting and something approaching sincerity, and the results are kind of amazing.
Okay.
He'll be at the Lightbulb Club tonight at 9 o'clock, and it's $5 to get in. And Les Claypool, who's been with Primus, has a new country-sounding band called the Duo de Twang.
Yes, saw them at Harvest Festival.
How were they?
You know, I caught them walking somewhere, so I didn't get to sit and actually enjoy it.
Were you floating? No, that was a different...
You'd have to ask Kevin Kinder. He actually got to sit and see the whole set. I heard them in the distance between here and there.
Well, he liked them enough to pick them as one of the highlights of the week. And they will perform Tuesday night at 9 at George's Majestic Lounge. And tickets are $23.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Reams have been written about Memphis, Tennessee's place in the creation of rhythm and blues, rockabilly, rock and roll, and blues music. But on the other side of the Mississippi River, often forgotten, is the pivotal role Crittenden County's West Memphis, Arkansas, had during this period as a playground of Memphians, West Memphians, Mississippians, and beyond, with its music, gambling, and nightclubs. The first river bridge between the two Memphises opened in 1892. A second bridge opened in 1916. The city of West Memphis incorporated in 1923. The population of West Memphis nearly quadrupled during the decade of the 1930s. Greyhound racing became legal in the county in 1935 and remains so today, but plenty of things went on in West Memphis that were not legal. With Memphis, Tennessee's 9 p.m. noise ordinance and West Memphis authorities paid off to look the other way at the gambling, drugs, and prostitution, nightlife on the Arkansas side swelled to a fever pitch. 9th and 10th, and especially 8th Street, became the center of West Memphis's scene, but the rowdiness was not confined to that area. In the 1940s and 1950s, venues in town such as the Joy Theater hosted live burlesque shows that had been banned in Memphis. Later, artist and musician Jimmy Crosswaite, who lived in East Arkansas, remembered screenings of nudist colony footage and stag films and said West Memphis was where Memphians could get extra wild. Musician and West Memphis native Wayne Jackson recalls regular cockfights being held under the River Bridge. Many of the West Memphis revelers were from Shelby County, Tennessee's Naval Base in Millington.
Oh, last night.
Launched in 1942, the Plantation Inn nightclub was a favorite spot for West Memphis debauchery. The club hosted such legendary house bands as Gene Bowlegs Miller, Ben Branch and the Largos, Willie Mitchell and the Four Kings, and the Phineas Newbern Sr. family band, with sons Phineas Jr. on piano and Calvin on guitar. Isaac Hayes sang with the Ben Branch band for $5 a night. Nicknamed the P.I., Morris Berger and his son Louis Jack owned the club, which had once been an actual plantation house. A neon sign reading, "Having Fun with Morris," was hung near the stage and was also the name of the radio show hosted by Berger and broadcast from the P.I. Other West Memphis night spots included the Square Deal Cafe, the Little Brown Jug, the Willowdale Inn, the Busy Bee, the Cotton Club, the Blue Goose, and Pimpy Jones's Pool Hall. West Memphis radio was part of the mix as well, broadcasting rockabilly and blues, much of it performed live on the air by the likes of Sonny Boy Williamson, Howlin' Wolf, Johnny Cash, and Elvis Presley. Alan Wolfe, Robert Lockwood, Junior Parker, Sonny Boy Williamson II, B.B. King, and countless less-known bluesmen all lived in West Memphis at various points in their careers. Alan Wolfe, in particular, acknowledged the musical amalgam that occurred in the area. Wolfe and others took the Delta blues and added amplifiers and drums. While it became known as Chicago-style blues, Wolfe and other of its practitioners called it the West Memphis sound. The February 1960 murder of a Memphis girl by a Memphis boy on the Arkansas side brought much of the wide-open West Memphis scene to a quick halt. Less than a week after the incident, Danny's Club and the Cotton Club both closed. The Plantation Inn stayed open for a few more years until 1964, but the family diversified. They opened Pancho's Mexican Restaurant with a club in the back called the El Toro. West Memphis's legendary Plantation Inn became Pancho's parking lot. Here in its entirety is Sonny Boy Williamson II, a.k.a. Rice Miller, with West Memphis Blues from 1951 on Trumpet Records out of Jackson, Mississippi.
Sonny Boy Williamson II, a.k.a. Rice Miller, with West Memphis Blues from 1951. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of KUAR and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer is Keith Merks. For more information, go to arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1998.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Last month, the University of Arkansas hosted Michael Dorcas, herpetologist and professor at Davidson College in Davidson, North Carolina, to speak on campus. Dorcas's research focuses on the ecology and conservation of amphibians and reptiles. He stopped by the Carver Center for Public Radio to speak with Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas about one of his areas of study, invasive pythons in Everglades National Park. Burmese pythons should not be living in the wild in the United States, but hobbyists tend to like to keep them as pets. And because people either let them out or they have escaped, they are in the wild and causing quite the problem. And as Dorcas told Christina, they're moving northward.
Southern Florida is the place where they're, where they were first detected and where they've been thriving. And they've, are expanding their range northward in Southern Florida to some degree. Exactly how far, we don't know yet, but they've certainly expanded their range considerably since they were first recognized as being established in Everglades National Park, which is in the very southern tip of the Florida Peninsula. And then subsequently, they've been found on Key Largo, which is the first of the many islands, extending down off the tip of Florida.
Well, so here's my question. Do more people just have pythons as pets in Florida, or how are they winding up down there as opposed to other areas?
That's a really good question, and we're not quite sure. Certainly, the subtropical climate of South Florida facilitates survival of individuals that might be released or escaped, and it's done so for many species of reptile. I mean, there are Nile monitors; these are lizards that can get to be 8 feet long that are now established and reproducing in Florida. There are numerous other species of lizard. There are boa constrictors in one part of Florida, that have been there for a long time. So certainly the subtropical climate probably promotes their, ability to survive in the United States when typically they would be in more tropical areas.
Here in northwest Arkansas, we're sort of on the northwest corner of the southeastern United States. Mm-hmm. So if I, let's say, myself and four of my best friends, we each have a python that we can't handle them anymore. And so right. We all go down to the Buffalo River and we let our pythons go at the same time. Would they be able to sustain themselves here in this climate?
That's a really good question, and we don't know the answer to that. There's a lot of factors that go into whether those animals could survive. And specifically, you're probably talking about surviving the winter. And, so both their behavior and their physiological tolerances play roles in those and in whether they can survive. And in addition to the habitat, are there places where if they want to, they could get deep underground? Are there armadillo burrows, which I know there are a lot of armadillo burrows around here, that might facilitate their ability to survive the winter. But we just don't know.
Well, you mentioned the size of a monitor, the lizard.
Mm-hmm.
How big? I mean, pythons, we're not talking, a 5-foot black snake.
Right, exactly. Yeah, no, Burmese pythons are certainly one of the largest snakes in the world. The record size that's been found in Everglades National Park is around a little over 18 feet. But there have been, several snakes that have been found that are over 17, and then you got, more and more as you go down. But certainly a large female python, the females get larger than the males, can approach, potentially 20 feet.
And how big around?
It's going to vary depending on their reproductive status. If it's a female that, has just laid eggs, she might be relatively thin, but they might be as big around as, certainly a large person's thigh, that kind of thing.
I never thought I was scared of snakes. And I went to the reptile museum that we have here. I mean, it's mm-hmm. just a guy that, it's essentially his, kind of personal collection of reptiles.
Sure.
But, yeah, I was a little freaked out. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're snakes like any other snake. And so the danger they pose to humans is probably very, very small. But it certainly is possible that, a wild python could kill kill a human. It happens in captivity. People that keep these large snakes in captivity every few years, you see the news and there's somebody that's killed by their pet python. And usually it's the python, it's feeding time and the snake gets a hold of them or, you know, something related to that. And, you know, the snake is normally a very docile snake, but it mistakes, them for food. And if a large snake like that gets wrapped around you, it can certainly kill you.
And that's how they kill their prey, is by constricting.
Yeah, they're constrictors. So they bite their prey and get a hold of it with their mouth, wrap around it, and essentially, kill it that way. But, you know, we have many constrictors here that are native to the United States. You mentioned, black snakes or black rat snakes are constrictors. King snakes are constrictors. There are many snakes, not just pythons and boas, that use that technique to kill their prey.
So they don't really pose a threat to humans. What kinds of problems are they causing in the Everglades?
Well, they pose a very low threat to humans. That's for sure. But the main problem that appears to be that we're documenting is the impact on native fauna and specifically the impacts that we've seen on common mammals. And so we've seen both temporally, both before and after pythons have proliferated, and spatially, based on where they have expanded their range, declines, very severe declines, in once very common species of mammals that are consistent with pythons as being the reason that these animals have disappeared. And so, for example, in Everglades National Park, there are 99% fewer raccoons than there were before pythons proliferated. 99% fewer possums, 87% fewer bobcats. Rabbits appear to be essentially eliminated from large portions of Everglades National Park. So there appear to be just across the board species that were once very common to see, that have just been nearly removed from the park. And it's very consistent with pythons as the major factor affecting them.
Those are huge percentage.
Yes.
That's
very huge.
Right,
exactly. And so the next question, obviously is, well, if you remove, if you have those kind of declines in these mammals, what, are the cascading effects that has on the ecosystem overall? And so we're starting to do some research to start examining those kinds of things as well. But those kinds of, anytime you have a food web that's as complex as that we have in the Everglades, it's really difficult to predict ahead of time exactly what the impacts of altering, the abundances in such a drastic way can be.
I mean, this is a relatively new problem. I mean, it hasn't been, late 90s or so, maybe?
Yeah, but pythons were recognized as established in the year 2000.
Okay.
And we have, since that time, now they certainly were established long before that, but they just occurred in densities that, we'd find a python here and there, but people didn't really think necessarily, oh, these things are reproducing here. And about the year 2000, scientists started saying, I think these things are probably established here. And since that time, the number has, that we encounter has increased dramatically, and since that time also we've seen the impact on mammals in a relatively short time, within essentially a decade.
What kind of numbers are we talking?
Numbers of pythons?
Mm-hmm.
That is a really good question and something that we really need to know, but is extraordinarily difficult to answer. Pythons are extremely secretive, just like other snakes. And in fact, some of the research that we've done, in fact, with my primary colleague on most of this research, J.D. Wilson at University of Arkansas, shows that the detectability of these snakes is less than 1%. So what that means is, if you go out looking for pythons and you find one snake, you've walked by more than 99 without seeing them. And so they're extremely difficult to find, which makes estimating their numbers very difficult as well. But the fact that they're a cold-blooded animal or an ectotherm means that they require, an individual snake requires much less energy to grow and reproduce than, say, a warm-blooded animal like a mammal. And therefore, because they require less energy and less food, they presumably can occur at considerably greater densities than a comparable apex predator that was a mammal that was introduced as well. And so that probably plays a very large role in the dramatic impacts that they appear to have had in Everglades National Park, is that potential to occur at just incredible densities.
Well, so chances are good, you know, I've never been to Southern Florida, but I know, you know, I picture the big flat-bottom boats with the big fan behind mm-hmm. it. You know, you're taking a tour of the Everglades. So I'm a tourist, and I'm on one of those boats.
Sure.
Chances are good that I won't see one.
Exactly. You might go buy 10 of them. We don't know for sure because, you know, there have been numerous estimates of densities of these animals, and most of them are just, you know, at best, you know, educated guesses, and some are just total guesses. But we really don't have a good idea. Are there, you know, tens of thousands of them, or are there hundreds of thousands of them? You know, they're spread over a very large area now. We're probably talking about, you know, at least 8,000 square kilometers, maybe 10,000 square kilometers. So it's a very large area. Additionally, much of the area is essentially... it's at least not easily accessible by humans, because there are vast areas in southern Florida where there are really no roads that go anywhere close to a large part of the place where, you know, where pythons probably occur.
Well, so what is the solution to the problem?
It's an excellent question. And there have been various efforts to, you know, increased detectability. For example, you know, there have been efforts to use dogs to sniff them out. And certainly, you know, that might help in certain situations. For example, if there's a wading bird rookery and you want to make sure there's no pythons feeding on the nestling birds and stuff, you could bring dogs around and maybe sniff out, you know, pythons that are right in that area. Or if there's a python in a neighborhood, you know, somebody saw, we need to go find it in this neighborhood, you know, that kind of thing. But we don't have any approach so far that shows any promise of suppressing the snakes across their entire range. We may be able to do it in very localized areas that are fairly accessible, but across the entire range that they're occurring now in South Florida, we don't really have anything that shows any promise of you know, even suppressing their populations.
So, I mean, you could maybe isolate one small area and try to catch them all in that area, but
possibly.
You leave that area and they're just going to infiltrate the area again.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. So it's a very difficult problem to manage.
You mentioned mammals, that, you know, that the pythons are eating a lot of the mammals. But what about... Aren't there a lot of alligators in the Everglades?
Yeah.
Is there some sort of maybe... wolf pack, or what am I trying to say? You know, alpha male sort of thing going on there.
You mean like competition
between
the apex predators? Actually, the alligators in the Everglades, at least the data that we have, show they eat a lot of snakes and they eat turtles and things like that. They will eat mammals and wading birds from time to time, but their primary diet is not mammals. And so there's probably not that as much overlap as we might think with that. And actually, pythons have been known to eat alligators, and vice versa, too. You know, if you're a big gator and there's a smaller python that goes by, you might grab it and eat it, just like you would a big water snake or something. And so so certainly they're both, you know, top predators, and not much is going to mess with an adult, you know, 10-foot adult alligator. But certainly they prey on each other. We have documentation of that occurring both ways.
Has there been more regulation as far as having exotic animals as pets?
Yeah, there are now laws in Florida, you know, because of this, that make it illegal to own, you know, some of these large constrictors without very specific permits that you have to have. And then there has been some additional legislation, modifications to the Lacey Act, which deals with importing animals, that has basically made it illegal to import certain species of large constrictor, including Burmese pythons, and also made it illegal to sell them across state lines. So it's really impacted the people that, you know, would sell and import and breed these animals quite a bit.
Why did you first become interested in this python issue?
Well, I mean, ever since, you know, like many herpetologists, you know, I grew up just fascinated with snakes. And like I told you before, this is, you know, this is a mess, but it's a fascinating mess. And so there are all sorts of very interesting questions that need to be addressed and that can be addressed using this situation, you know, looking at the impact of apex predators on ecosystems and those kind of things, and then also trying to figure out ways to manage this situation. So there's a lot of interest in that regard, but it's also, I love snakes. And so that was why, you know, I've studied snakes, you know, for a long time, and that was what got me involved in this, was my expertise and experience with studying snakes.
What is it about snakes that you love?
That's a really good question, and I've thought about that a lot. And you know, they're unique. I mean, certainly when I was a little kid, you know, it was, I could go behind my grandparents' house and turn over rocks, and I could always find some little snakes, you know, and I was always just fascinated with them. You know, they're able to survive without legs. They're able to do all of these really amazing things, and there are snakes that. You know, the more you study them and the more you learn about them, the more remarkable they are. I mean, for example, these pythons, you know, have the ability to, you know, if there's plenty of food around, they can eat like pigs and grow and reproduce rapidly. And but if there's not enough food around, they can go a year without eating and be just fine. You know, just really remarkable, remarkable animals.
That was Michael Dorcas, herpetologist and professor at Davidson College in North Carolina. He is the co-author of Invasive Pythons in the United States, Ecology of an Introduced Predator. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas while he was in town last month.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, we'll talk with Danger Mouse and James Mercer about the new Broken Bells album, After the Disco.
It just seemed to sort of sum up this sort of melancholy after the party, finally facing reality and stuff like that.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF 91.3 FM. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, P. Rich. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. And we'll end today's show with some music by Hank Williams Jr. He is one of the performers at Riverfest, a music festival in Little Rock, taking place May 23rd through the 25th. Each Tuesday this month, they're announcing new headline acts, and so you can hear the next announcement tomorrow. You can check that out at riverfestarkansas.com. Thanks again for listening, and I hope your week is off to a fantastic start.
I guess it's because I kind of changed my direction. Lord, I guess I went in.